discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time. On Wednesday, January 20th, 2021, the little palindrome that is Inauguration Day. And thank you for joining us for the 101st episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, pardon me, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight, as always, is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that, and if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, unlike the last two times when I did the song that was related to the trivia, tonight it's related to the topic, so that's a tune called Doing It Right. Since people with compulsivity tendencies, such as Mawa, like to do it right, that's what she said, I decided that would be a great tune to open the show with, and besides the fact, it's one of mine. So it's a two-for-one-er.
Cute. All righty. So as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode, as the last two, is entitled OCD versus OCPD, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin that topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So what a lot of people don't realize is, when the supposed, if you will, reunion happened back in the day of the original four KISS members, and from that point on, not every KISS member played on every song on every record. And since there was a lot of contentiousness between certain members, who shall remain nameless out of good taste for a change, which I'm not usually known for, but hey, you know. let's just say that a lot of folks stood in for other members. And that was also the case because certain members were too busy starring in movies and really didn't have time to do studio work. So what I wanted to talk about tonight was a bunch of KISS songs, that some of which are extremely famous, that Gene Simmons did not play bass on. And those include the following, and I'll tell you who played bass on them. So Shandy, was played by Tom Harper, who was actually a roadie for Kiss, and he filled in for the bass duties on that. Creatures of the Night, which has a fairly excuse me, complicated bass part, was done by Mike Porcaro of Toto fame. So he stood in and did the bass for that. A producer of theirs on one of their records, Jean Beauvoir, played bass on Get All You Can Take, Thrills in the Night, and Under the Gun. excuse me, Ace Frehley played bass on The Oath, Talk to Me, Torpedo Girl, and Two Sides of the Coin. Bruce Kulick, who was one of the guitar players for a while that came in for Ace Frehley, played on Every Time I Look at You, one of their best hits forever, and Psycho Circus. And the bass player of Tears Are Falling, which of course is a very famous Kiss song, Love Gun, which is a very famous Kiss song, Easy As It Seems, which is more of a deep cut, Tomorrow, which is more of a deep cut, and then their all-time best-selling song, which I personally go, what the heck were you guys thinking? I Was Made for Loving You. And the bass player for that is Paul Stanley. So there are a lot of those songs, like Tears Are Falling and I Was Made for Loving You and Forever and Love Gun, that everybody thinks Gene Simmons played bass for, and that was not the case. So I thought that would do like a little revealing this evening and say all that glitters is not Gene Simmons. Even though
oh, don't tell
plays
him
those
that.
In concert. Yeah, really. Although he certainly plays those in concert and, you know, covers them well. But in the studio, he was not there to do them. And he was either doing movies or he was having difficulties with various members. So he decided he was going to bow out. So the other folks, Ace Frehley and Paul Stanley, being two of the original members, of course, of Kiss, took the bass role and assisted by Jean Beauvoir and Bruce Kulick and Mike Porcaro and Tom Harper on the other ones. So there's your not-so-all-original reunion albums and who played bass on them for real in the studio.
Wow. Okay, thank you very much for that. Cool stuff. Again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, diving right into the topic. This one has become a three-parter. It's the topic that ate Chicago and 3D Sensor out. All right, so this is part three.
Well, because we wanted to be compulsively complete.
Yes, yes, that is absolutely true. Guilty. So this is part three of three. Last two shows were also about this, and we don't like to shortchange you guys on the information. So if we run over, then so be it. And this is the remainder that we had not yet covered. So, as a reminder, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, and its lesser known and misunderstood counterpart and related pathology, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, OCPD, are both disorders that many people know, but the majority of lay people don't properly understand and about which are misinformed. Many people use these terms interchangeably or to label simple fastidiousness or being particular. Tonight, we hope to educate our audience on the correct and most current understandings of these and related disorders. In past episodes, we have talked about OCD and OCPD in episode 7, Armchair Psychology, that was October 2016, episode 24, Pathology Chic and Misconceptions, that was June of 2017. Episode 69, Hobbies and Collecting versus Hoarding, that was May of 2019. And of course, our last two episodes in December and 2 weeks ago. So we've talked about it in relation to other conversations, but we hadn't previously until now done a show dedicated to these related pathologies specifically. OCD is one of the more popular pathologies to tackle in media, pop culture, and entertainment, and it is surrounded by a laundry list of stereotypes, bad data, assumptions, near romanticizing of the having of it, and other inaccuracies that we hope to address, explain, and or debunk this evening. Obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, and its lesser known and misunderstood counterpart. Oh, I beg your pardon. I've posted something twice. Please forgive me. I'm not going to read that to you twice. That's silly. Let's skip that. So, this is the last two shows that we discussed. The first one was an overview of OCD and OCPD. That was December 22nd. And then 2 weeks ago, January 6th, we did a current understanding of OCD and OCPD. And now tonight we will pick back up and we'll discuss myths and misconceptions about OCD and OCPD and resources for OCD and OCPD. You know, either resources for getting over it or coping with it or living with somebody who does. So we'll start off the evening with some topic-relevant classic rock, which Dr. Mathis has already graced us with, and our trivia. And now is our topic discussion. So before we begin, I'd like to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you have anything you want to say before we jump in.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. So we've talked about an overview. We've talked about current understanding, and we're going to come down here to the third section, myths and misconceptions about OCD and OCPD. So the phrase obsessive compulsive is sometimes used in an informal manner, unrelated to OCD, to describe someone as being excessively meticulous, perfectionistic, absorbed, or otherwise fixated. That's from the wiki. And here I'm going to impose on you, Dr. Mathis, if you could give us a very brief summary in your professional understanding of OCD versus OCPD versus perfectionism versus control freaks. And there's thin lines between each of these and how they are interchangeable and how they're not interchangeable, despite how people use them. Is that something you can help us with?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So generally speaking, obsessive compulsive disorder is a form of anxiety disorder that involves a lot of rituals, behaviors that you repeat over and over in order to avoid certain feared consequences. And the feared consequences are usually things you can't put your finger on. So if you say to an OCD person, hey, why are you checking the light 15 times when you've already checked it, you know, 14 times and the light was off? Well, just to be sure. Okay, you realize that's kind of like overkill and irrational, right? Yeah, but, you know, and it's always the yes, but. And so when you look at an OCD brain, this is much more, for lack of a better term, a biochemical, excuse me, what I often refer to as BBFs, biochemical brain farts. And don't try this at home. These are professional terms. And a wiring issue that tends to be more genetically involved, even though you can certainly get OCD if you have an extreme enough trauma in which something you didn't do or should have done or did, you know, or overlooked or whatever caused some major catastrophic problem and your brain kind of miswired itself in the process and you ended up being OCD. But more commonly what happens is it's a gradual disorder that grows over time. It starts in childhood and usually runs in families. So if you have a person that has an anxiety disorder, they're much more likely to develop OCD than the person who doesn't. But of course, that's only an increased likelihood. There's other things that have to happen for that to occur. So OCD people, it's a much more serious disorder than OCPD. So the OCD folks in general require some kind of biochemical assistance. They're most often put on anti-anxiety meds of one kind or another. Although, you know, I have folks who are managed during with cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the adjunct to the medication, and doing holistic stuff as opposed to the medication route, because all medication has side effects and the medication really doesn't fix anything. It just puts a band-aid or a bullet wound, and that's true of every psychotropic on the planet. And I'm not slamming them out of hand, because there's some cases where, you know, those are really helpful. But in most cases, not so much. OCPD is basically that's a personality disorder, and it falls into cluster C. So all personality disorders are subdivided into cluster A's, cluster B's, and cluster C's, and they're grouped according to theme. So the cluster C personality disorder folks are all grouped according to this irrational fear anxiety component. So they look like an anxiety disorder, and they're certainly based in uncertainty and anxiety and fearfulness, but they're not really an anxiety disorder because they're a personality disorder and it's a less serious situation. So generally speaking, OCPD people can manage their stuff with some training and some cognitive behavioral stuff. They can manage their symptoms without any kind of psychotropics whatsoever. And they're really, you know, they can be taught to do that, and it's not that difficult. And if they can take the OC tendencies and kind of rechannel them, as I have, then it can actually be a boon. There is almost no condition where OCD is a boon to somebody because they can't usually manage it. So I describe OCPD people as being sort of perfectionistic pains in everybody and their own tushes from time to time if they don't manage it. So kind of the sort of quintessential pop culture icons for this. So if you've ever seen the TV show that used to be on called Monk had OCD. If you've ever seen the movie As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson had OCD. If you've seen The Odd Couple or seen the play on Broadway, Felix Unger has OCPD, along with hypochondriasis and a bunch of other things. But he's more of an OCPD guy. Jack Nicholson and Monk are much more OCD folks. Okay. So it is very often where people will use the terms interchangeably, perfectionists with OCD people, with OCPD people. And technically speaking, OCD people tend to be perfectionistic, and OCPD people are perfectionistic also. The problem with the OCD people is they almost never get anything done because they're always going back and redoing things. They're always going back and, okay, oh my God, I found this one dust speck on my floor. The dust is filthy. I've got to redo it again. Oh my God, I didn't do a good job. And so they'll spend 8 or 10 hours mopping their floor for the 15 millionth time. So they never get – their perfectionism clearly is counterproductive and gets in the way, and they don't accomplish dog crap. And so they're always a day late and a dollar short. The OCPD people can manage it much better. They both have perfectionistic traits. They both do perfectionistic stuff out of fear that if they're not quote-unquote perfect, if they don't dot their I's and cross all their T's, some bad stuff is going to happen. Now, if you ask them – they'll go, I don't know, but it's going to be bad, right? And I'm the same way. And, it, you know, as I've joked about many times, but it's true. I mean, I do have OCPD and really like it. But that's only because I've learned to channel it most of the time, he quickly adds, into things that will help me as opposed to things that will screw me. But if I don't manage this stuff right, it will definitely come back to bite me in the assets. I mean, it's a balancing act, you know. Yeah, to quote Mr. Anderson on Beavis and Butthead, you're going to finesse it. Control freaks is a term that people will use offhand, so to speak, and that could describe OCD people or OCPD people, but it also has been used to describe borderline personality disordered people and narcissistic personality disordered people, which are cluster Bs. And what I tell folks is, while they both appear like control freaks on the surface, their raison d'être for being in control is very, very different. So the OCPD and OCD person wants to be in control because they are afraid and they want to make everything right for themselves and for other people. So they want to make the world a safe place, essentially. They're not doing it because they have, as one of my friends would say, and excuse my rudeness, the bigger dick theory that they want to wave, right? That's not their modus operandi. They're not trying to prove to themselves how wonderful they are because they really have no self-esteem, and they're just trying to control external things as a reflection of how much in control they are when they're really not in control, and they're trying to convince themselves that they are. That is not OCD or OCPD people. That is, however, the modus operandi for most borderlines and most narcissists. So they want to show their stuff off, and they want to prove how wonderfully masterful they are by controlling everybody else and all the things in their environment. It's not a fear-based control. It's I have no self-esteem, and I'm trying to delude myself that I do by controlling things outside of myself because I have no control of myself or anything inside of me. So it's a very different dynamic. But on the surface, if you can't differentiate the modus operandi, you think that they are really all coming from the same cloth, for example, and they're not. They are very, 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 very different. In real time, Howard Hughes had OCD, right? Joan Crawford had more OCPD-type tendencies, but that comes out of, OCPD tendencies, but that really got manifested because of her borderline personality disorder. And so she was a control freak because she was out of control of herself, and so she wanted to control everybody else to show everybody else how sweet and wonderful and in control she was. And the only thing she did was alienate everybody. So that's a very different phenomenon than Howard Hughes, who was a control freak because he was a germaphobe, and oh my God, and that's why you see these guys, won't shake hands without gloves on, and they're wiping door handles down because most OCD people are germphobic. OCPD people don't usually have that. And control freaks don't usually have that. So, and perfectionists don't usually have that, although some do. So, sometimes, to quote one of my heroes, you have to be very, very careful, counting perfectionism. So you have to ask yourself. One of my students in one of my classes, when he was writing his summary of the class, his critique of the class and his evaluation of the class, he goes, great lecturer, best Elmer Fudd ever. I'm like, okay then. I don't think the school's going to be very impressed with that. But anyway,
it's
thought
official.
It was very sweet.
It's
a very different phenomenon. So you really have to look at what is the underlying modus operandi for the perfectionism and the control at what appear to be control issues. Is this person controlling to make a safe place so that everybody wins? Or is this person a control freak so that they win and everybody loses, as in the case of the cluster Bs? Right? Very, very different modus operandi. So while they might look to the naive observer on the surface like the same thing, they ain't even the same animal. That's like saying a Fender Stratocaster is the same as a Gibson Les Paul. They're both guitars. They both make music. But boy, do they sound different. And if you have a discriminating ear, the difference is very recognizable.
Got it. That's a great analogy for that, too, especially coming from you. So thank you.
Yeah, well,
for that.
Mr. OCPD with the instruments, I'm like,
of course,
what do I think? Can I apply this to other things, right?
Yep. Exactly.
Sometimes you
all
just
right.
Gotta laugh at your shit. You gotta laugh at your shit, right? And the OCD people they have a much harder time doing that. It's a much more worrisome thing for them. The OCD people can occasionally laugh at their stuff and roll their eyes at themselves and go, really? Right? The narcissist and the borderlines, which are both cluster Bs, not so much. And the OCDs, which are the anxiety folks, not so much.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's go ahead and dive back in now that everybody is kind of reminded of what we covered the last two episodes about the differences, because you guys will need to bear that in mind for what we're going to talk about right now. First, I want to throw in a quick thing on hoarding. It has been a surprise to some people, including myself the first time I heard it, that hoarding, believe it or not, is currently, it's considered a possible subset of OCD or OCPD. In my research, I have found that this is actually becoming a subject of hot debate. And it's not well confirmed by research. This is the assumption, but it's a weak one. And the professional industry is arguing about this a lot.
Yeah, if you look at the DSM, it's a separate diagnosis, the hoarding disorder.
Yes.
But you're right. Yeah, there is a shoot ton of, in some cases, very heated debate about, no, it's really a subset of OCD. And so there's all this back and forth, you know.
Right. And essentially what I found is when people say that, especially if they're professionals, that it's simply that they're operating on old information, which is why I give you guys the date of things that I read to you, so you know how current is that versus if you want to debate that, you know, who's got the newer study. And as a matter of fact, that dovetails right into the very next paragraph that I wanted to read to you. This is from a post called Normal or Not, When Collecting Becomes Hoarding, and this was by Wynn Perry. And this was written in May 2013 at livescience.com. And this quick snip I thought was relevant to our discussion. It says, until the release of the DSM-5, hoarding was considered to be part of obsessive-compulsive disorder. But the APA task force behind the newest version of the manual back in 2013 has given the compulsion to excessively collect things without value its own diagnosis. And this is in alignment with what Dr. Mathis just said. And the fact that it used to be in the previous DSM, the part of OCD, a lot of people have not moved on from that yet and paid attention to the changes in there. And then the next thing I want to read you guys real quick is this is actually from the same source, but it's a different paragraph. So recent research suggests that nearly 1 in 5 compulsive hoarders have non-hoarding OCD symptoms. Compulsive hoarding is also considered a feature of obsessive-compulsive personality disorder and may develop along with other mental illnesses such as dementia and schizophrenia. And the source for the last part is International OCD Foundation. And then the last thing I want to talk about is Hollywood portrayals of OCD or OCPD. I know Dr. Mathis named several people when he was talking earlier, and there might be a couple repeats in here. I know Joan Crawford's going to be one and possibly Howard Hughes. We have several Hollywood portrayals of this, and they are varying degrees of accurate. And feel free to stop me if you want, Dr. Mathis, if you want to comment on that. The biopic Howard Hughes in The Aviator 2004, that I remember when we were discussing, I didn't put it in my notes, but that I remember we considered that fairly accurate.
Yes.
Okay. Joan Crawford, the biopic in Mommy Dearest 1981, our notes from when we discussed Pathology Chic said that this was of debatable accuracy. She had OCD, a cleanliness obsession, but possibly also BPD, narcissistic personality disorder, and paranoia, amongst a few other things that Dr. Mathis reiterated earlier. So that's kind of a mixed, somewhat accurate, but kind of ham-fisted, and leaving a lot of stuff out. Melvin Udall in As Good as It Gets, 1997. Raymond Babbitt in Rain Man, autistic savant, and as part of that, he's also OCD, and it's part of his savant pathology.
That's
Roy
not
Waller,
as common.
Oh, yes. Savants have, they typically have OCD, right? Not OCPD so much.
Correct.
My understanding.
Correct.
Okay.
And the reason that you sometimes see hoarding with dementia patients and schizophrenia is because of the memory issues. And the schizophrenics, of course, are in La La Land, so they don't, wait a minute, I didn't do that. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. So it's more of a, hey, I forgot I've already got this shit. It's not like, oh, I've got to get more of it. It's more of a memory and reality checking issue with them.
They lose track that they already have 6 of them, so they go buy another one because they forgot all about it. Okay, got it.
Uh-huh.
And then the last one, Roy Waller in Matchstick Men in 2003, This one was of debatable accuracy. He may be OCD, but he's also agoraphobic. Is there anything else that you would like to add as far as some of the media and entertainment portrayals of these pathologies that we haven't really covered?
I actually don't know Matchstick Men. I may need to look at that.
Okay, that's fine. That was from a list of these things that was recommended, and I know that we had covered several media that you weren't familiar with, so I tried to make notes, you know, where notes came from. So there was a few I'd never heard of either, to be fair. So, all right. So the next thing that I would like to talk about is resources for OCD and OCPD. And the first thing is therapies. So according to the wiki, a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, and we've talked about this on the show with other applications before, and also psychotropic medications are first-line treatments for OCD. Other forms of psychotherapy, such as psychodynamic and psychoanalysis, may help in managing some aspects of the disorder, but in 2007, the APA noted a lack of controlled studies showing their effectiveness in dealing with the core symptoms of OCD. So this is usually the go-to, but they're realizing that they're not sure how much it helps. It kind of depends. The specific technique used in CBT is called exposure and response prevention, or ERP, which involves teaching the person to deliberately come into contact with the situations that trigger the obsessive thoughts and fears, in other words, exposure, without carrying out the usual compulsive acts associated with the obsession, which is the response prevention part, thus gradually learning to tolerate the discomfort and anxiety associated with not performing the ritualistic behavior. At first, for example, someone might touch something only very mildly, quote, contaminated, such as a tissue that has been touched by another tissue, that has been touched by the end of a toothpick, that has touched a book that came from a contaminated location, such as a school. And, you know, some of you may be giggling, but you have to understand people that have this pathology potentially could freak out if they knew this. So, you know, you have to learn to get over it. So that is the exposure. The ritual prevention part is not washing, because that's the first urge that comes up for somebody who has this issue, is, you know, this overwhelming compulsion to go wash it off. Another example might be leaving the house and checking the lock only once, exposure, without going back and checking again, which is ritual prevention. The person fairly quickly habituates to the anxiety-producing situation and discovers that their anxiety levels drop considerably. They can then progress to touching something more contaminated, so to speak, or not checking the lock at all, again, without performing the ritual behavior of washing or checking. Actually, that reminds me of a question that didn't dawn on me till just now, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot extempore.
Sure.
Why is it when people have OCD, and this may vary by why they have it, why is it that washing and compulsively checking things are some of the most common ritual behaviors? Like, why do they go to those?
It's a form of feeling safe. I'm going to check the locks to make sure nobody can come in and hurt me. I'm going to check to make sure I don't have any contamination on my hands so that I don't get sick and somebody else doesn't get sick. Because, oh my God, germs are bad. To go with Mr. Mackey on South Park. And, you know, oh my God, if I have these germs, I'm going to get sick. If I get sick, I'm going to die. And so it's this what if that just snowballs like crazy. And so the whole thing is to show them that if they don't do the response, nothing bad happens. So it's like a reality checker, no pun intended. So they're like, okay, got it. If I don't do this, I'm not going to die. I'm not going to get sick, and I'm not going to spread germs to somebody else, and they're not going to get sick and die. Hey, okay. You know, so it's kind of giving them a really kind of a reality checker in terms of, you know, okay, so you checked the light one time. You're sure you weren't spaced out. You weren't drunk. You weren't sleepy. You're sure you turned it off. Yeah, let it go. What's the worst that'll happen? You'll burn up a dollar or two worth of electricity. You'll come home and go, oh, shoot, I left the light on. Okay, no big. Is the house going to burn down? No. Is this guy? No. Then why are you freaking out about it? So it's, again, grounding them about the reality of the consequence of not checking or not washing your hands every time. You know, you see somebody across the room sneeze and you go run out of the room and go, oh, my God, you know, kind of thing.
Got it. That, I'm curious, how would you differentiate the line between something like that and some forms of PTSD hypervigilance with the environment? Because a lot of that is also about checking your safety or whatever, but it's maybe grounded a little more in things that actually happen. I don't know if
Yes.
you have an opinion on that.
Yeah, and sometimes you will see people that have had extreme post-traumatic stress type disordered situations, particularly where life and limb has been at stake, reality life and limb has been at stake. And if it's a bad enough incident, they will develop OCD. They have a chance of developing OCD. So that was a great question.
Got it. Okay, so my next note says, ERP, the therapy we're talking about above, has a strong
right.
evidence base and is considered the most effective treatment for OCD. However,
yes.
this claim was doubted by some researchers in 2000 who criticized the quality of many studies. A 2018 review found that self-help metacognitive training improves symptoms in OCD. A 2007 Cochrane review found that psychological interventions derived from CBT models were more effective than treatment as usual, consisting of no treatment, waiting list, or non-CBT interventions. So generally, it has been accepted that psychotherapy in combination with psychiatric medication is more effective than either of these options alone. And quick notes
so
about possible treatments. Go ahead.
So did you want me to comment on that or no? Okay.
So well,
what
I
would say is...
I've got two more sentences for the whole section, so I was going to get those out unless you think they're going to cause a longer discussion, in which case I'll wait and let you go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to do a quickie if you don't mind.
Yeah, let's go ahead.
So, you know, CBT is great if you have somebody who knows how to apply it. And CBT is a broad-based therapy that think of it like a big umbrella that incorporates behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, rationally motive behavior therapy, and dialectic behavior therapy. So you really have to match the version of CBT to the client and his or her presenting issues, personality structures, and all that kind of stuff. So that's part of the problem. The second thing, and most of my colleagues, with all due respect to them, don't do testing. And this is the beauty of doing testing, because you know how somebody's brain works and you know which one of those to pull and what tactics to pull out of each one of those. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And the other thing I would say is I found a lot, and I would agree that if you're going to combine CBT with some kind of biochemical assistance, that's your maximum effective thing. But biochemical assistance doesn't have to be medication. It can be the food you eat and the vitamins, herbs, whatever that you take. It does not have to be medication. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. So the next section is very small. It's about treatments. And this first one has also brought up something interesting. Again, something that's dawned on me reading it now and wasn't in my notes. So the first thing it says
okay.
is naturally occurring sugar inositol, I-N-O-S-I-T-O-L, has been suggested mm-hmm. as a treatment for OCD. Now, where it gets interesting is that I had been talking to my chiropractor a few months ago, and we were trying to chase up a study that I found, and I want to say it may have been from NIH or something similar, and it was a follow-up to a study in California about treating diabetic neuropathy, because there's mm-hmm. a cellular change, there's a coating on certain cells that gets eroded by diabetes, and one of the treatments that they've been experimenting with in this study that they did was myo-inositol, which is related. And interestingly enough, that
yes.
chemical is also used to treat PCOS, of all things. So it's kind of fascinating to me how these three very disparate situations, you know, one is a mental health issue, one's a physiological issue coming out of diabetes, and the other one, PCOS, is, you know, hormonal imbalance issue. They're all surrounding inositol, which is basically a sugar. And I'm fascinated by this. I don't know how much you know about it, but go ahead. Yeah, let's talk about it.
It's a carbocyclic sugar that is natural to your brain and other in your it's in your tissues. So it's not like a sugar.
Right. So how would that help it make progress? And these three things are not technically related, but it seems to help help OCD. Yeah.
So first of all, there is very scanty evidence that it helps with polycystic ovary syndrome. The evidence is really sketchy. It's less sketchy with OCD. And it's kind of the same scenario with that as it is with the mu opioids, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because what they're doing is they're transforming. So when you start using basically a sugar that's natural to the body produces, okay? And you can find it in plants and certain fruits like oranges and cantaloupes, for example. What you're doing is rebalancing the brain's sugar level chemistry, natural chemistry level, for lack of a better term, in terms of the OCD stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're talking about in some cases is the sugar going kind of crazy that dysregulates the brain, that then dysregulates things like GABA aminobutyric acid and production of things like serotonin, norepinephrine, and all that kind of crap. So it's kind of a complicated thing, but that's sort of where it's going. It's to regulate the brain chemistry so that the brain can regulate the hormonal stuff.
Got it.
That's very different. A different mechanism from the mu opioid receptors, which are typically referred to as MORs, M-O-Rs, and sometimes referred to as MOPs, which is the mu opioid peptide. And those are different because what those do is those directly suppress gamma aminobutyric acid, so which is related to things like anxiety. So you can see where this is coming into play. So what happens is it suppresses the excess release presynaptically of GABA.
Okay.
And so that's why it's sometimes used for OCD symptoms. And what you'll see typically, the for lack of a better term, the apex or the prototypical at receptor agonist for MOPs are morphine, right? And the psychoactive ingredient in morphine is opium, right? Which then kind of starts this whole process going. So all of the MORs or MOPs have a high affinity for things like beta endorphins and beta enkephalons, which are calmers and soothers, as opposed to the dynorphins, which are not. And they have a very low affinity for the dynorphins. So this is, again, to get the body to release its natural calming mechanism and suppress the release of certain chemicals that the brain would do during a fight or flight anxiety kind of thing. So that's sort of a complicated thing. I'm trying to make it a little simpler, even though I'm not being exactly correct. That gives you the idea of how this works.
Okay. Good. That's a lot of science, but we do that here, so that's cool. The next part, I think, may have been notes. I'm not sure if I got them from you or not. They're very scientific, so I'm going to tiptoe through this because this is not my bailiwick. But it's a note about there's a symbol, and I'm not sure if it's a symbol for mu. Mu or mu?
Yes, that's the Greek mi, which Americans pronounce mu, but it's really pronounced me. So in Greek, The MU is pronounced me and the NU is pronounced knee. It's not pronounced mu and new, but yes.
Ah, okay. So I was told that it was a term in psychology statistics, but I'm not sure how
goes
along with opioids. Okay. Okay.
It's a biochemical. And
so
there are different variants of. Right, and there's not just one mu opioids. There's like variants of it. It's like there's not one dopamine molecule. There's a bunch of them. So there's like, 10 or 12 different variants in humans. Mu1, Mu2, mu that kind of thing. So it's the same thing.
Oh, there really wants to be a Pokemon joke there, but you won't get it, so I'm not going to do that to you.
Yeah, you're right. I wouldn't.
Pokemon,
but
I'm just having fun.
Yeah, so. Yeah, so this is a neurological, neurochemical term, not really a psychological term. The only psychological term mu, the population mean, is a psychological statistic term, but they've stolen it from, the Greek meaning the average. But when they use it in terms of opioids, they're talking about a specific type of opioid receptor. So it has really nothing to do with psychology. It has to do with brain pharmacology.
Okay. That's me just trying to make it make sense when this is not my strength. But that is what they were talking about. Yeah. So it is the opioids.
Yeah,
and this class is stuff like hydrocodone and tramadol. And the studies had suggested they may improve OCD symptoms. Again, the overall emphasis I want you guys to take away from this is that several of the suggested pharmacological remedies are not well documented to be certain they work well. They kind of help some people-ish, but this is kind of all we have that seems to do any good. It's not really a big vote of confidence. So understand that when these things come up, if you're looking for help for yourself or you're looking for help for somebody you're with, they need to do more studies on these things. It's not necessarily that they know it's bad and they're doing it, but it's just they don't know much of anything and they're kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Right. That's correct. And it's pretty new. So we're, this is sort of a new version of pharmacological treatment. So, it's going to take them a minute.
So it's new mu.
That's right. That is correct.
All righty. So is there anything else that you would like to add as far as treatments and that sort of stuff? There were not a lot of notes that I found that I thought had much veracity. So this is a small section.
So what I tell most people is you're better off doing some version of cognitive behavioral therapy once you figure out which version is going to be best based on the assessment you do to know how your brain works. And then there's a lot of naturopathic things you can do that will help calm and soothe your brain. And you're much better off doing those because those aren't addictive, those don't have side effects. And then, the worst case scenario is if that doesn't work, you can always turn to the meds.
Yep. Fair enough. Okay. So, honestly, that pretty much concludes my notes on this. We managed to get through three episodes. Now we have most of that out to you guys. So, in summary, we hope now that our listeners can better understand OCD and OCPD, and we would really like to see this cut down on erroneous self-diagnosis and even romanticizing of these pathologies, and this is stuff y'all learn through media and entertainment. It's not all funny Jack Nicholson or Felix Unger or any of that other stuff. It's not even Rain Man. It's not cute, and it's not... You can't just figure it out. Oh, my apartment is super neat, so I have OCD. It's not like that, and we really encourage you guys to stop doing that. All three episodes get into detail about how you know the differences, but don't use those to just decide you have stuff. Because if you guess wrong or you leave things out and you don't have a professional help you, then when you try to fix it, you're going to pick stuff that either doesn't work or that breaks you worse. So please get professional opinion. Use this as a springboard to go, this sounds familiar, and stop doing it yourself. We encourage that with all the pathologies we've talked about, not to do with the self-diagnosing. Use that as a starting point for a conversation.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, Dr. Mathis has made a career out of cleaning up other people's bad diagnoses. So...
Yeah,
that's
I'm dealing with that right now, actually.
Oh, yikes. Well, I
and
hope you can
help. It's really sad because this particular individual has gone through many years of being misdiagnosed and therefore mismedicated. It's just really sad. It's incredibly sad.
Yeah, I can understand that. So hopefully the notes from these three episodes will help our listeners not go through that as much as we can help you guys avoid it. So
absolutely.
Anyway, this concludes our show, finally, on OCD and OCPD, and this really will be the conclusion this week. Is there anything else on the topic that you want to add before we wrap that part up?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we will see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, February 3rd, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. And we'd also like to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. As I've mentioned the last couple of times, I don't necessarily have specific episode information for some of these, but these are a general idea of when these shows air, if you guys want to check them out. So Thursdays are Travel Itch Radio, 8 p.m. with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. They came back from hiatus in January. I do not know what the current episode is about, but you can check them out tomorrow night. Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. Sundays, 8:30 p.m., The Walking Dead and or Fear the Walking Dead and or World Beyond, online viewing party. So we are slated to return in February 2021. Stay tuned for possible one-time special presentations. Most of them are over. We want to possibly do the Walker vocabulary primer for you guys. You know, 101 different euphemisms for walkers in the extended universe. Anyhow, those will be Sunday nights, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We resume the last weekend in February. I did not catch the date, but we'll hopefully see you guys over there as well. Mondays, 10 p.m., Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega. He brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. And this show may alternate on some Monday nights with our new show, The Nightmare Hunter, with Roger Noriega in the same time slot. And finally, Tuesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fandom Access. We can review. Join the ingenious insights of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they digest another night of TV. So thank you guys for joining us. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We will see you in 2 weeks. And don't forget to rock on. Good night.